Can I have everybody's attention? One order of business. You'll need to know. We did have this room reserved for the next time, but I guess they played a trick, and I'm not sure we're going to get it. So keep your eyes on, I guess, the Central Indiana website. Sandy's getting your emails. Maybe we'll put a little flyer in. There might be a new place in a month from now.
Because this latest flyer, we've got to say it's going to be here.
Right.
And so I've got your emails, and I will send out a notice if we change. And I'll put it on the website, Jim.
I think we're shooting maybe try to find a library, public library we can meet in or something like that. Because we're a not-for-profit. We're not charging, so we might qualify. So we'll let you know. Just so you know, before you come next time, make sure you know where it is. One other little detail. We've pretty much gone through part one, chapter four, which is very important. Just to give you an idea what all this stuff is in the book, if you ever read it. For example, paragraph 67 to 90, I just tell you this for an example. What Jung will do, see, he'll quote that, her poem, and then he goes on and cites other creation poems like hers to see where there are similar themes. So he'll go 10 or 15 pages on that, and you think, why is he, whatever happened to the poem? I thought we were talking about the poem. Just remember, he's doing this cluster thinking, this symbolic thinking. He'll start with something, then he may give two or three or four parallels to it. You kind of have to hold the thought where you were, realize he's taking a detour. When that detour's over, come back to where you started. Otherwise, you'll get lost. He does that quite a bit. Again, to enrich the original image with other similar images for the sake of comparison. I'm not going to say that to you every time. There are many places in the book he does that, but he does do that. And when you find him going off, just remind yourself, what idea is he taking off from? Stay with that idea until he comes back to it. She then has another poem which she writes, and I have just given us the first two lines for the sake of time. So now on page 2, paragraph 115. The poem is called The Moth to the Sun. I longed for thee when I first crawled to consciousness. My dreams were all of thee, and in the chrysalis I lay. It goes on from there, but I've just tried to capture the essence of it. So she's putting herself in the place of a moth who's longing for the sun. And what Jung does after that, he quotes a couple other poems where a very similar theme is discussed, and where the object of the longing is not just the sun, but stars. And I say that so the next sentence makes sense to you. The passionate longing for God is like that longing for the singing morning star. That's in another poem, so he's referring to one of the other comments he makes. But he's now seeing in that poem the very same dynamic that he saw in the previous instance, where the girl longed for the man but may not have been aware of it and ended up producing an image of God in her poem. Here, the moth longs for the sun the way she was longing for that man and by extension for God. All of that symbolic thinking there. So it's just another text for him to see the very same dynamic of the attraction between herself and some image of divinity, here symbolized by the sun, and in other poems by stars. Pretty soon what he's going to do is do some of this cluster thinking again to show us that this is not such a strange leap as it may seem, because very often images of God in myth, and we will look at some of those examples, are said to be the sun. This is the symbolic process, as it were. And then he's going to make another step further to say that sometimes that these images of the sun are not only gods, they're heroes. So he's making a chain of associations in this next chapter 5 between the god of the previous vision, previous poem, the sun of this, and the hero, to show us that they are all, if you look at symbolic stories throughout Western, or basically Western culture, that's not such a strange leap. Linearly, it doesn't make sense, but if you look at how they appear together in myth, it does. I will show you some pictures to make that a little bit more obvious in a minute. Now he reaches so now we've heard the basic idea. We're getting another text, and we're just going to keep circling around what we've said from different points of view to help make it more clear and to go into it in a little more detail. So really nothing new is going to come up. It's just representing what we've presented at greater depths as we go along. Paragraph 125, he says, a helmsman with bronze skin and black mustachios and the loftiest ideas of religion? Impossible. But, he's saying, they have in common the fact that both are the object of passionate desire. And it remains to be seen whether the nature of the object alters the quality of the libido, quality of the desire. Well, what's so important about that? Something remains constant even though the object of the desire is different. She's longing on the one hand for a man, for a god, for a son. And he's saying it doesn't matter that they are so different, because what's important is that she's longing for something. And the nature of the energy that is motivating her longing is not the point. It is that she is longing that is the point. It doesn't matter that it's a sexual longing. That's not the point. The point is there's something she's reaching for.
So you're saying the thing that you would circle on that one is not the really the objective, it's the path to get to there?
Is
the
is, what is this thing?
The bridge.
It's the bridge. Just because this whole thing is spoken in a sexual language isn't the point. The point is that there's something here trying to go from point A to point B. And that's what interests him. That's what he wants to talk about. Not by the quality of the experience, but the intensity of the experience. The quantity of the experience interests him, not the quality of the experience.
Here in Wong, the energy shifts in all the time. So Wong, as the symbols come up, they'll change or shift, and oftentimes we get possessed or caught by that image, that symbol. And it's not the symbol that he's looking at, it's what's creating the center. But that energy world, it moves.
But I think just the opposite. Let's see, this is not easy stuff. The point isn't for him that because there is a sexual experience that he should begin asking about, he should begin asking sexual questions. But because there is energy, he should be asking where that energy is going, not what the nature of that energy might be because of a particular cause.
So he's not going back to where the energy
is. He's not going back to here.
No, beyond that.
He's going up to here. This is where he wants to focus.
Okay.
this is where we will be focusing.
Is the bridge a two-way street? The energy doesn't just go one way, does it?
Well, that's a tough question. That's basically the way he's talking about it here, but that will be something he will change as he goes along. Yeah, I think he's saying he's not emphasizing at this point. He probably is alluding to it, but certainly by the time we would get to ION, he is emphasizing. Is it that this pushes over here, or is it that this pulls from here? But again, this is somewhat of an academic statement he's making to the Freudian approach, because the experience has a certain quality, whether it be aggressive or whether it be sexual or whether it be vanity, that is riveting the person's attention, that's where you begin questioning to find out its origin. He's saying the form of the energy isn't important. It's the quantity of energy that's important, and not what its character is, but where it's headed. It could have any character. That doesn't matter. The point is where it's going.
Gary, could it be that the energy that
is
contained is like a container, a small problem, so it would encompass the whole thing?
Yes.
And so the image would be in there, and she would be in there, and the archetype.
You might say that the energy is the message, and in her case, the sexuality is simply the language. And don't confuse the language and the message, is his point. Whatever that language is doesn't determine what the message is.
If you have a simple thought, dreams that basically change the scenes, but you focus on what is the, like the desire that you have about her, that she has just different desires for.
Mm-hmm.
So you all focus on the feeling that it evokes more than the object.
Well, you might have to focus on the feeling it evokes, but more, you know, no matter what the form of this experience is, it may have a goal that has nothing to do with the form of the experience. It may be a sexual feeling and not be about relationship. It may be that sexuality is the language used to express something of your future that it could have to do with writing a book or getting a new job or learning a new skill. But when a certain experience has a certain quality, and I think, you know, basically we're dealing with either sex or aggression, nowadays maybe vanity, that one thinks, oh, because the nature of the experience is sex, power, or vanity, that the solution to this dilemma has to do with sex, power, or vanity. But it may not. It may just be that when that is trying to communicate something to you, and where you see the truth of his position is when that understanding is made real to you, the desire vanishes. You may have a sexual desire, you understand it's not driving at a sexual issue, and you'll see that confirm when you hear the meaning of that sexual desire, and the desire vanishes, and it has not been a change in your sexuality. Does that make sense?
The desire might change, but the energy
will still be there for the new thing. The energy goes into the new thing, and you realize that the sexuality or the aggression was merely the carrier. And Jung is saying, be careful you don't confuse the carried and the carrier. Just because the carrier is sexual, or the carrier is narcissistic in today's language, or the carrier is aggression, doesn't mean the message is.
The delivery.
It's the delivery system. Mm-hmm. It's the mailman, not the letter. And, of course, you know, I don't think, you know, psychologists certainly moved past traditional Freud. But even still today, I think, you will find, if you'll hear somebody immediately jump to an interpretation about an experience based on the nature of that experience. If it's a sexual issue, then they begin asking sexual questions. If it's a power issue, then they begin asking power questions. If it's a narcissistic vanity issue, then they begin asking about what's thought to give rise to that behavior. And Jung is saying, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe all that stuff is just the means of bringing your attention to something that has nothing to do with the way that energy has appeared to you.
A good example of that, I think, is Iraq.
Well, let's not get into that.
No, but I mean, in other words...
I really don't want to get into it, okay? Let's go on. Paragraph 134. Now we're going to hear him redefining what I just explained, the difference between the first and second formulations are. Slowly. For whoever introverts libido, that is, withdraws it from the external object, digs up from the treasure house of memory those images glimpsed long ago. So this is no longer dad, this is treasure house of images. Dad is simply one form of those images. So the fact that dad is present in her vision may have nothing to do with her relationship to her father. It may just be the image used by that energy to express itself.
So then if you have that image, then are you going to look at that image and figure out what does that image mean for her? Because that's part of it. It's not that image, but it may be whether it's power or
right.
control or love or whatever.
Right. Right. I get it.
The same thing in the dream.
Same thing, yeah.
And some of those, you've got this image of father, some of those outshoots could be completely opposites of
right.
love.
So, you could dream of father, you could dream of son, you could dream of hero, you could dream of torch. And it doesn't have to do with dad. It has to do with the meaning that this dream process is trying to create through those images. Again, it might have something to do with that, or it may just be the language used to communicate a totally different point. Jung feels that's the case here.
And then you look at the energy that is conveyed in those separate images.
Yeah.
And where is the energy?
Where does the energy want to go? Irregardless of the form it has appeared to you in, where does it want to go? And when it gets there, the goal that it has reached may have no semblance to the form that it first presented itself to you in. May. Yes. See how different this is. And again, it's not trying to overthrow what Freud does, the basic causal model, but just say there are more strings on that violin than just that one. Now, more, as I say, what we'll be doing is looking at different parts of this chart, bit by bit, examining in more detail. Here we're redefining that. I just used the phrase treasure house of memory. He goes on to express it in a little more detail, paragraph 138. Regression makes the use of the parental imago, but only as a symbol. That is to say, it closed the archetype. That's certainly a rewrite. I don't think you would have said archetype in 1912. That is to say, it closed the archetype in the image of the parents, just as it bodies force the archetype's energy by making use of sensuous ideas like fire, light, heat, and he gives more. So I've just stated what I just stated in slightly different language.
So the archetype itself is no good father image.
Right. The archetype is the capacity to generate images.
architectural?
Yes.
So what, how is this going to be for design?
Her desire was simply the energy that activated the process to generate images, which surfaced in her poem. And what the archetype does is transform her energy into a particular image for her to contemplate. Maybe I could mention, could be a point of confusion that maybe some of you know, some of you don't. The difference between the archetype and the archetypal image. Jung doesn't always use them so exactly. He really would be a lot easier if he does. Sometimes he'll say archetype and he really means archetypal image. But the archetype is the capacity to produce an archetypal image. So the hero would be an archetypal image. The archetype of the hero would be the capacity to generate that hero image when it is needed.
So there are still many archetypes.
Right. A given archetype may generate many different types of archetypal images. So this archetype we're talking about with her, the self, let's say, could generate its meaning in terms of a father, could generate its meaning in terms of a fire, of a torch, of a sun, of a sound, and so on. All those would be archetypal images, but the central archetype would be, probably he's not using the word self at this point. Basically, he's going to say the hero. The basic archetype is the hero. And we'll talk about that in detail as well. But later he'll call that the self. Is that okay? It's not an easy point to grasp, and I must confess, I don't think he's always so clear. I mean, he's clear in his head, but he'll write archetype, and he means archetypal image.
So some archetypes more powerful than others, like the self, is that?
That would be central, I think, yes. Yeah, I think that would be central.
Could you say that she's being introduced to the self through the archetype of longing?
Absolutely.
So the archetype that's being generated here is the self, but it's showing up through the archetype of longing, that energy field.
You're almost right. She's being introduced to the self through the hero image generated by longing.
Okay.
Yes. See, it's just, he changed the order. But that's such a hard thing to get through our heads, because we're so used to thinking causally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do this for a living, and I still have trouble thinking in the new way sometimes. It's just so different. But once you realize it, it just changes everything. Where I've seen it most directly is in sexual transference with women, where, you know, both of us are utterly seized. I may have said this, some of you heard me say this before, bear with me, but you think, oh my God, you are the one. I will throw everything away for you. And you reach an insight, and it is gone 1 minute to the next. At 10 o'clock, I was willing to throw my life away. At 10:20, I'm thinking, oh shit, why am I mad? I can throw my life away. It's gone. And what they are left with is a new fundamental orientation in their life. And when that takes place, it goes away in them and it goes away in me. So you realize that it was not about sex. It was about their next step in life. And they were being introduced to that next step through an understanding that was moved forward by sexual attraction. Yeah. Key difference. Yeah.
So, Gary, does it get to be a point that it takes less to move forward?
Well, in theory.
So that you can have that easy one.
I think we're all so stubborn at heart that, I know I always have to get slammed on the side of the head. Yeah. Because you think, well, I'm in touch, you know, I'm on the right path, and sure enough, you're not. Yeah. I would like to say yes to your question, and maybe to a certain extent there is, but I think as human beings, we're all, our judgment is so whacked out sometimes. Okay. So we're redefining. We've looked at this a little bit again. Now we've looked at this. Pretty soon we're going to start looking at that. I mentioned these images. These images were the God, the Father, the Son Hero, all different manifestations of this. So really, I should redraw this self, God, you see, Son, Hero. That should be there now. So this Father is really a form of another reality. It's the form of the self. It's not the thing. It's just what happens to appear in her case. Now, because what Jung is going to do now is focus on the hero and say that the main image around which all these other images coalesce is the hero. And for quite a while, the book is going to be about the hero. That what she is longing for is the hero. As he says, I mentioned these images to show how the light symbolism gradually develops into the figure of the hero. And I brought along some pictures. This is one of these leaps, and unless you know myth, will sound nuts to you. But if you know early myth, very, very often, the sun and the hero and the god are all the same figure. So I just brought along a couple of pictures to try to demonstrate that fact. Here is the god as a sun being transferred from the barge of the evening to the barge of the morning in ancient Egypt. And it's both a sun and a god. The god's in the center of the sun.
The god is Ra.
That's Ra. Here is a German male that is the sun. So he gives a gazillion. I've just brought along a couple. So you can orient your thinking to his thinking that he's looking at how these mythological images overlap in myth to make his leap in interpretation that from god to son to hero. Here's the sun in Egypt, who is the king, and the sun at the same time. And here is a German son as a human being. Right. It will stop at saying because the way she described her experience was of a father god, that it's about the father. And Jung is saying no, that father is simply one language used by the self to express its point, as it also uses the son, as it also uses the hero. And the most important psychological image there for our purposes is the hero. So we've gone from hero to ship's mate to god to son to hero, and the legitimacy of doing that is their equivalence in early myth. This is the symbolic thinking that Jung warned us about under two types of thinking. Now that bothers the linear mind. It does not bother the nonlinear mind. The easiest way I think I can explain that is in your dreams, it is not strange in your dream that you're in Paris and Rome at the same time. That's the level of thinking that we're working with, allowing ourselves these logical contradictions because the thematic messages are similar, which we see when we go back to early myths, how these images are conflated. Okay? So it's a big shift. Because now we start looking at the fact that this God that we've talked about and this Son that we've talked about is really, they are really two different forms of the hero. And what he's going to talk about at great length is that what is the psychological meaning of there being a hero in her imagination? Even though we don't have hero yet, we will. Even though we don't have hero yet, by the symbolic link, he feels justified in turning the discussion to the hero. You follow me? Okay. By the laws of symbolic thinking. Not the laws of linear thinking, but symbolic thinking. So now we start to make a shift. And the discussion will talk for a great length of time on the hero. He says, under the symbol moth and sun, we have dug deep down into the historical layers of the psyche. And in the course of our excavations, have uncovered the sun hero. The reason he says that is because of the mythological parallels. The sun hero who revolves around the earth. Now comes the big new shift. And who rises again in rejuvenated splendor to give light to new generations. See that, remember the Ra that she referred to? Goes through a death and rebirth every day in the Egyptian mind. The sun dies in the evening, is carried in the boat of the underworld, and is reborn in the morning. For him, the dreamer longs with her very soul. For him, the soul moth earns her wings. So we've gone to from sun to hero, and then from hero to death and rebirth. Follow that? This next sentence should make it more clear. The ancient civilizations of the Near East were familiar with a sun worship dominated by the idea of the dying and resurgent god. Osiris, Tammuz, Attis, Adonis, Christ, Mithras, and the Phoenix. I brought along some pictures, not of all of them, but some of them. These early Mesopotamian gods were all connected with the sun, and they all died and were reborn yearly. Here's, I think then it was called Anatolia, today it would be Turkey, the myth in Anatolia around the birth of Christ, before and after. Here's Attis. Here's Osiris, dead. Here is the son being reborn out of his mother.
What is it?
That's Attis and the great mother, Kibble. I'll talk about Osiris in a second, but here's Osiris as the column. And here's Osiris is reborn. I'll tell you about that in a second. Here's another Mesopotamian myth, Marduk, and he is slaying a serpent. Now, things are getting more complicated. The what Jung turns to, because of the link, the symbolic link, between sun and hero, is to looking at the role of heroes, sun heroes, in pre-Christian and slightly post-Christian myth. I gave you a couple of examples. Osiris, Egyptian, Tammuz, Sumerian. Sumeria would be like Iraq today. Attis would be Turkey, then Christ, we know. Mithras would be Rome. These gods had two characteristics. They all, three characteristics, they all were connected with the sun. They all were lovers of their mother. And in that, they all were killed and reborn. So what Jung has brought into the discussion now is two new elements: the relationship to the mother and death and rebirth.
Did you say killed?
Killed.
Okay. So the people around
him? No, the mother.
Oh.
This was a destructive incest.
Oh, okay.
I've just made some huge leaps. If you're upset, please holler. But I'm following his chain of symbolic thinking. Son, hero, death and rebirth, destructive relationship to the mother.
Why destructive?
She kills him. Kills the son. Yes. Or some version of her. Now, I'm really trying to go step by step. And if you're with that idea, I'll go to the next idea, but I don't have anyone throwing up on the table here. So, you with that? This hero is going to be one of the main focuses of the book. And there are many varieties. And he'll spend chapters on the difference between these two. We don't have to exactly worry about that, I don't think, for our introductory level. What I would be happy if you can just understand what there is to understand at the basic level, namely that he's turning his discussion to the hero and why he's doing it, and that basic paradigm I just said, son relationship and destructive relationship to the mother, has many varieties. And he talks about each variety, and he makes important psychological statements about each variety, but I don't think for our purposes we need to go into it. I'm just trying to give you the top layer here. Just do know there's more to know about what there is that I'm saying, and if you read the book, then you will get, you can say, oh, yeah, he'll be talking about Tammuz, he'll be talking about Osiris, yeah.
Does he become the hero because he goes through this cycle of rebirth? Is that kind of, because if you look at the year, the wheel of the year,
mm-hmm.
the pagan calendar kind of thing, it starts out with at midwinter or a winter solstice, she gives birth to her son.
Yeah.
And then...
Same idea.
At Beltane. But is he becoming a hero because he accepts the role? And goes through with the death because he knows he will eventually die.
I guess you could say because. I think for them it's just the story.
I just wondered kind of how the hero, how he really became the hero.
He is this is the myth that society chose as their dominant myth. And you can watch... I will throw this out. You can watch... Well, let me tell you Osiris' story, and then make sure I come back to your question. Just to give you one example. Osiris is the Egyptian god. And he gets into a fight... Let me make sure I get this right. He gets into a fight with his brother, who throws him in a coffin. Kills him. Throws him in a coffin. The coffin floats down the Nile to the Mediterranean and floats to the coast of what today would be Lebanon. And there, the coffin comes ashore, and a tree swoops it up. And the color picture of Osiris, he then becomes the tree with those, which is the column pictured in that picture with the two arms. That's Osiris, dead, wrapped up in the tree. The king sees this pretty tree, makes the tree a column in his castle. So that's how he gets to be a column. So he's dead, but he's wrapped up in this tree. And his wife, Isis, goes on a hunt for him, finds him, rescues him, brings him back to life. And the guy gets into another fight with his brother, who kills him again. This time he chops him up into 14 pieces, throws him into the river. Isis goes searching for him again, and finds 13 of the 14 pieces. The thing she can't find is his phallus. She remakes a phallus, conceives on the corpse a child. That is the top picture of Horus as the sun, on that colored picture that I was passing around. So what you've got is you've got a hero. He is killed by some figure. At first, the figure is a maternal figure. Later, it becomes a man related to the maternal figure. He is rescued somehow and brought back to life. That's the basic paradigm. In this myth, it's not so much that he's brought back to life, but he gives birth to a new son, and he's the son that's been killed. And in creating a new Horus, a new young son, he in essence rejuvenates himself. Now, in those early myths, he's just beaten up and then brought back to life. And he's passive. And Jung shows us this is part of the argument of the book, not really germane to our main point, but I think we'll hopefully get to your question a bit. As those myths develop, see, Egypt's 3000 BC, 4000 BC. As those myths develop up through, say, the Roman era, and up through the civilizations of Mesopotamia, he gets more active. He doesn't just get beat up, he fights and is killed in a heroic battle. But he still is killed. Later, by the time you get to Babylonia, he is not killed, he kills the slayer. But the basic idea in those myths is this death and rebirth of this hero figure through some connection with the female goddess.
But in Osiris, where is the destructive relationship?
Well, in the earlier versions, he is not killed by the man, but by the woman. But as the culture evolves, it's separated out that it's not the woman, but another aspect related to her. In that case, it's her brother who kills him. It's all very complicated, I know, but it's what we have to do if you want to understand this. Yeah.
This is alive and well. I just heard on the news that in Israel, a young soldier was killed, and he never had any children. He wasn't married. And his mother had the doctors take his sperm, and she has now gotten a woman that will agree to carry the child. And there's a whole big thing going on in Israel right now about this whole legality of this. So I just heard on the news yesterday. So I mean,
Isis did the same thing in a way. Yeah. But the thing I want to leave you with is where the discussion goes and why, and it's not a normal way of thinking, but the logic behind it is symbolic logic. That the image points to the hero, and the basic quality of the hero type that it points to is that it dies and is reborn. Are you comfortable with that?
curious, though, in where's the destructive internal in Christ?
In Christ?
Well, it's putting that in the same.
The tree that he's crucified on. I'm trying to keep it simple, but just like, you know, we, is this too much or, okay. Just like we'd look at the various images that refer back to the hero, so we can look at the very various images that refer back to that feminine figure, and one of the typical representations of that feminine figure is the tree. So sometimes the hero is killed by the woman, sometimes he's killed by the woman's brother, sometimes he's killed by a tree, and in Christ he's nailed to the tree. So it's the same mythological substructure, even though the varieties are quite different. Again, if this is taxing your brain, it's because it's symbolic thinking, it's not linear thinking. Now we have a big ergo to make here. What is she longing for? Her own rebirth. We're going to be looking at the hero as her capacity to turn back to herself, to lose her current orientation, that would be the death, and to create a new one and find a new basis for her life, that would be the rebirth. So Jung's, and I'm anticipating, we will go through this step by step, Jung's position now is, it is not about sex, it is not about power, it is about rebirth. The meaning of her moth fantasy, her moth poem, her creation poem, is that she's longing for her own capacity to turn back to herself and change. We reach that through the symbolic logic of similar themes being expressed by various different images.
How does that relate to the energy of the archetypes? That different archetypes, the energy comes at different times.
Well, that death and rebirth theme for Jung is the primary dynamic of the self. And when it is time for a death and rebirth, when it is time for a change, these experiences are generated using all the different languages we've talked about for the purpose of conveying to us the need to return back to ourselves, to allow our current values, our current attitudes to die and to give birth to new ones.
Do they all revert back to the human archetype? I mean, even though you have the
derivatives
along the
pathway,
they all...
Yes. Well, at this point for Jung, they do.
Yeah.
But when we get to alchemy, he will start using other metaphors for that death and rebirth.
But it is death and rebirth.
It is death and rebirth. Yes. Death and rebirth, and I think he will expand it a bit, death and rebirth through the synthesis of opposites. Yeah.
The bridge is. Can the bridge be different things? Is the bridge always going to be longing? Or you have to determine what.
It can be different things, certainly. Yeah. I think the two basic ones are lust and hate, desire and antipathy. I would add, you know, given our current psychological climate, a third is vanity. I think that's a shift. Since Jung, it wasn't alive when he, in his day.
Would that be carried by humility?
No. I'm This is the world according to Gary. He doesn't say this, and I'm not sure about this, but I'll throw it out, that we're seeing the two basic languages that he thought the self spoke to us through were sex and aggression, and all he's doing is taking Freud's basic two instincts and showing that they are languages as well as instincts. I'm saying I think today there is another language that's being used, and that is vanity.
That because of the death of the body?
I think so. And I think that's changed even in the last 10 years. We're seeing a new drive populating our time.
So what would that do like to somebody? It must be special.
Yeah, what is vanity? What do you consider?
Well, what the Freudians are calling narcissism today. This me has behind it the same dynamic.
Can you give an example, like, you know, understand I'm the attraction for someone or really...
But see, it's not for anybody else, it's for yourself.
So you really...
People who are intoxicated with themselves.
Yes, in their emptiness. Is vanity an attempt to fill...
It may be. It may be another fundamental drive. I'm not sure we should get off on it, but I think times are changing. Yeah.
You're talking about little self, not
no big self.
Intoxicated with the process of finding yourself.
I was just trying to modernize this a bit from where Jung is. That I was saying, two languages that it uses, we've been saying, is sex and aggression. I'm saying I think there might be others, and one of those others might be vanity. That instead of longing for somebody else, it's this great drive to pump oneself up. And that itself is giving us a message. It's not, as people, as the Freudians would say, a simply a result of bad mothering. That it's an action of the self, just like sex and aggression can be. Sometimes. Yeah. But that's kind of off our point. But just so you know, I know how complicated this stuff can get. Okay, so just make sure you're comfortable. Let me go through the chain of associations. Symbolic associations, I know I've said it before, but it's so different, a way of looking at things that might not hurt to recap. We went from song in the night to God to sun to hero to death and rebirth. Now there's another factor to that equation, and that is, where does the hero go when he dies? Well, very often he goes to images that in myth are associated with female deities, with the maternal. So Jung's discussion now is going to turn to what does it mean for her that her vision is really about death and rebirth? What's that hero trying to tell her? How would I communicate that to her if she were my patient? And what does it mean that these heroes are destroyed by the feminine? That will be where the book goes for quite some time. But if you're lost now, you'll really get lost later. So don't be shy about asking if something's not clear. Well, we have just a second before lunch, and that will actually be a good place to stop, because I'm going to skip 168 because we've already said that. Chapter 2 is more of what we've already said, that simply because an energy has a quality doesn't mean that's what the energy is about, right? Not the sexual instinct, but a kind of neutral energy. It's just a repeat. Does that sound familiar to everybody? And then, I think I better spend some time on the next part. Well, what do we got? Maybe I can do it. A loss of the reality function must of necessity be replaced, if at all, by an earlier mode of adaptation. That's what we've been saying, that the father image comes up because she doesn't deal with her longing for the guy. We find this in principle in the theory of neurosis, which holds that any failure of adaptation is compensated by an older one, that is, by a regressive reactivation of the parental imagos. That's what, in other words, what we've already been saying, but does it sound familiar to you? You sure? Okay. The only thing it adds, which we won't make a whole lot of, is what is it that isn't happening? Not so much here, but in her life, that needs to change. The fact that there is something new here implies there is something old here. So whenever we are interpreting an image in our field, we are doing it with a foot in both worlds. One looking at the image, and the other is looking, what in real life is this addressing? Just so you know that, he's not going to make a great deal of that, because that's basic Freudian psychology. And what he's trying to understand is this, but do understand that he knows that if you're going to be talking about this, you also have to be talking about that. I think part 2, chapter 3 is the same. His phrase for what we've been talking about is canalization of libido, which means how does the energy channel from one form in the past to the future? That's why it's called symbols of transformation. Taking your energy from one spot in your life, how does it move to the next spot in your life so that what you move into is absolutely genuinely yours? Again, certain persons are therefore inclined to assume everything bears an obvious analogy to sex must of necessity be derived from it. We've talked about that, right? A comment on the practical implications here. One makes oneself and others believe that the problem is purely sexual, that the trouble started long ago and that its causes lie in the remote past. This is the important sentence. This provides a heaven-sent way out of the problem of the present by shifting the whole question to another and less dangerous plane. So you're running after my father or my parents, blah, 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 blah. What you really need to be doing is saying, how should my life change? And the fact that there are parental images in your dream might mean that that's a cause, or it might mean that they're there by virtue of there being a language for your change. And if you take them as about the past rather than as a metaphor for the current change, you get stuck. And infantile people love to blame somebody else. Well, that takes us to part 2, chapter 4, and which is the hero. So what we will do in the afternoon, we'll begin looking more at the hero, what that means for her, what is wrong about it in her case. So we'll continue looking at the hero as a paradigm and then go back to her personal situation. And we'll also be talking about where does the hero go when it dies. For Freud, this is incest. For Jung, it's incest as a symbol. So the discussion then will focus on those aspects of this demo process. We'll take a break, and we'll be back at 1 o'clock, and we'll push on.